Holmes, and we are back on WMCA. And tonight we'll be later in the show talking to psychics Rock Kenyon and Bill Case, as well as Tex Mars, head of the Living Truth Ministries, who is anti-New Age. He's a Bible fundamentalist who thinks all this psychic stuff is just a bunch of bunk. And that's later on in the show. And now, what's the deal with Gene Shepard? We have a telephone problem. Okay, so we'll open up the phones, and as soon as we solve our phone problem, we'll talk to Gene Shepard. Is it our problem or Gene's problem? Gene is there, right? Let's welcome to the to our telephone lines a radio legend, ladies and gentlemen. He's also famous for his books and his work on PBS and movies like A Christmas Story. We're delighted to have him with us this evening, Gene Shepard.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Gene.
How you doing?
How are you? Now, we have a bad connection.
Do we really?
That's a little better, I think.
There you go.
All right. Is this sounding as bad in there as I'm hearing it?
Well, you sound pretty good.
Yeah?
How do I sound?
Well, you always sound good. It's not you. It's equipment. But I'm glad to have you with us. You are legendary still in New York for your work on WOR over many years. You are remembered fondly by members of the radio community and members of our listening audience who every so often call up and say, why don't you have Gene Shepard on?
Well, I'm delighted.
But you have no interest in doing radio anymore, do you?
Well, it's not so much that I don't have interest in doing radio. It's one of those things I've just passed through on my way to, you know, expanding my career. It's like, you know, it's like asking Johnny Carson if he wants to go back and being a disc jockey.
Well, was that then just, it was just a way station for you? But you were... You belittle it when you put it in those terms because you are not just another radio personality or a disc jockey. You are a monologist who was so prolific that each night you're able to buy yourself with no net, just talk and entertain millions.
That's you know, I never thought of myself as a radio person. I was doing what any monologist does in a nightclub. I thought of myself, in effect, every night when I went on stage on the air, as if I was going on a nightclub stage and I was doing a monologue. I didn't think of myself as a radio man, you know, like people who do shows with weathermen and all that stuff. I never thought of myself as, you know, just per se a radio man because, you know, Alan, I came out of the legitimate Broadway theater.
Uh-huh.
I had done Broadway and off-Broadway stuff, and when I came to New York, I was brought to New York not as a radio man, but by a producer named Leonard Sillman.
Who did the New Faces show.
Yeah, that's right. He brought me to New York to be in New Faces of 1960. He had seen me in a review that I did out in the Midwest, and I was also doing a television show at the time, a comedy show. And he brought me out to the East, and I then did a few reviews in New York while we were rehearsing the show. But in an odd way, my agent called me one day and said, listen, while you're getting this show together, while you guys are rehearsing, he said, how'd you like to make a little bread? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I think I can get you a slot on the radio. He said, you know, attempt to do it just for the dough or whatever. So I started to do that show just as part of, you know, everything else I was doing. And the next thing you know, it took off, and now everybody thinks of me as a radio man, and anything else I've done is sort of subsidiary.
But that wasn't what you really wanted, was it?
Well, it isn't matter what I wanted. You see, I'm of the school of performer, Alan, that is really, I look upon every medium as just another way to do what I do. I don't think of radio as an end in itself, or movies as an end in itself, or whatever. I guess I'm a throwback to an earlier time, really, when entertainers would do movies, they'd do radio, they'd do nightclubs, they'd do all kinds of things. But now everybody specializes. You're a radio man or you're a television actress.
You talk about having done you said you just got on the air and did a monologue every night, but what people don't understand is that to do new material every single night, monologists who work in nightclubs, and you did a live show from the Limelight down in the Village every Saturday night, but the monologists who work in the nightclubs work to different audiences. They don't have to change their material regularly. You had to change material because if you're repetitious on the radio, people will kill you.
That's right, and it was a lot of work. I'm glad you you spot that, Alan. Every day, all my waking hours, basically, I was thinking of things to do on future shows. I didn't just come into the station and then just do a monologue. What I did, each show was prepared anywhere from 2 to maybe 3 weeks in advance, and I kept, you know, notes on what I was going to do on each evening. And I built the each show as a separate and individual monologue. So I didn't just walk into the studio and start talking, although it probably sounded that way to people. And that's incidentally what I wanted it to sound like. I wanted it to sound like, you know, purely he just walked in and he started to blab. Because I think this is the way all monologue should sound. I think if you go to a nightclub, you don't want to feel that this guy's working out of a set of absolutely immutable material.
What I found amazing is you would start your show right after the news. Was it 9 or 10 o'clock? I don't remember.
Well, it was a different time. Sometimes, at one point, it was on from 11:15 to midnight,
uh-huh.
And then it was on from 10:15 to 11, and they moved it back and forth depending on the whim of whoever was running at the station at the time.
Well, you know how radio programmers are. They throw a bunch of stuff against dartboards, see where it sticks.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's one of the reasons I really didn't want to stay too long in radio, because I don't think, and I'm not talking about your station or anybody in particular.
Well, that's okay. You can talk about the station.
I don't think radio respects its performers much, because it's really basically in the advertising business. And advertising is the end result of radio, and at least when I was working on OR and that, so I didn't feel that if somebody had just once come to me from the front office one day after I'd done a particularly good show and just come down and say, hey, that was a great show last night, man, I would have felt totally different. But all I ever got was, hey, how come you upcut the Campbell Soup commercial last night? That's all I ever heard, you know. And so at that point, I began to get feeling like, God, I want to get somewhere where my work is appreciated.
But I remember you as an excellent pitcher, because I still remember those Lucky Charms commercials you used to do.
Oh, yeah, I'm a very good pitcher.
And you would weave them into your story so it was undetectable.
That's right. And I don't want to see, the point is I began to get tired of that, because, you know, it would be a little bit like if Arthur Miller writing a play has to weave in Lucky Strike commercials, you know. Because I like to think of my work as a kind of an art. I didn't think it was really a way to sell material. And yes, I did weave them in, and it was at an expense to the story, I might add, that I was trying to tell that night.
Also, you would start right after the news, and you would start to weave a fabric. And the fabric would go off in many different directions. And I never knew how you did it, but just as the theme was starting, it would all come together toward the very end of the hour.
By design, Alan, I knew where I was going. See, any good storyteller has the end in mind before he starts the beginning. In other words, if you're gonna write a joke, you start with the punchline, not the other way around.
Uh-huh.
And so I always knew where I was going. And all the interweaved stories and comments and all that were all aimed at going to that one end. And that also was a hard style to develop, because most American listeners, because of the kind of stuff they listen to, are interested, or rather, let's say they're in a sense, oriented to straightforward narration.
Uh-huh.
So boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy finds girl. That's it. You know, you see on television, all the stories are very simple. They don't go off. The guy, for example, in a story, he's met a girl. Then they don't cut away and find out that he's also having trouble with a used car he bought.
Gene Shepherd is our guest on WMCA. Gene, for many years, held forth nightly on WOR here in New York, and has since gone on and done many other things. And as you put it very well, people like to type you and say you are a person of this medium, when in fact you are a multimedia individual. You've had a number of successes with PBS. Your books have sold, movies. What are your current activities?
Oh, I'm working right now. In fact, I'm about to fly out to the coast. I'm going out to, I love to say that, you know, that sounds so in, you know. I'm flying out to the coast. Even better, you say, I'm taking a red eye.
And you're going to do some lunches when you're out there, right, Gene?
No, no, not at all. I'm working on the sequel to Christmas Story.
Uh-huh.
I'm flying out to meeting with the director, Bob Clark, who directed Christmas Story, and we're beginning work on the very beginnings of a script for the sequel to A Christmas Story.
Are movies, motion pictures, a more fulfilling medium for you than radio was?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a simple reason. And it's not to put radio down. Radio is a great medium, but it's very limited in the sense that when I was on radio, and people could turn you off and walk away, or that's the end of it, and the next day, you'd have disappeared. People cannot take your radio show from 2 weeks ago and say to somebody, hey, watch this. This is fantastic. Listen to this show.
Yeah.
It's not preserved at all. It's like every night is like it's made out of snow.
There must be nights you do, and I think there are occasionally, once in a blue moon, I do a night, and you say to yourself, it's gone. It's not going to be aired again. It was a great show, and what a shame that it was a few hours, in your case, 1 hour, and that's it.
Well, I know it, and it got to the point where, see, and I'm a storyteller, and stories are supposed to be preserved. I mean, if Mark Twain just told his stories on the radio, you'd never hear of them anymore. I finally realized that I was wasting a lot of great material just every night, aiming it out at the audience out there, and half of them were half asleep or shaving or whatever. So, making love or eating pasta. So I realized that there were better ways to use my work. And so the big difference when you said about movies, I mean, movies are worldwide. And it's fascinating to get reviews on, say, Christmas Story from Holland or from Switzerland or Paris or wherever, all over the world it plays.
And people can review it and see it again and again, and you have VCRs and cable. And
I'll tell you, Alan, I would venture to say that Christmas Story today, 4 years after it came out, is far bigger than it was when it came out. As a matter of fact, it was recently named by the Boston Globe as one of the 10 best comedies of all time. Now you know, this is a very nice thing to know and to get that kind of recognition.
And you could do a great monologue on the radio some night. It could be a terrific piece of art, and it probably wouldn't get that kind of recognition.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, over the years, when I was doing work on WR, making people laugh every night, and there would be pieces in the Times or magazines, you know, about leading comics or humorists in America, I was rarely ever mentioned because I was on the radio.
Gene Shepherd is our guest. We're going to take a short break and come back and open up our telephones for low those many New Yorkers who have not talked to Gene Shepherd, maybe ever. We're 212-570-WMCA. We're out in the 570 WMCA. I'm Alan Combs. Tomorrow night, Roger Grimsby is our guest, and on the telephone now from his Florida palatial estate is Gene Shepherd. You've given up this part of the country, right, Gene?
No, I still have an apartment in New York City.
Oh, you do? How often do you get here?
I get there. I'm only down here because I have production studio down here, a movie company here.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you're down here because of tax reasons and one thing and another. the state is very sympathetic to people that are in the movie business. They're trying to bring movies down here. And, I have a place up in Manhattan, and I also have a place up in Maine, so I haven't forgiven that part of the country at all.
You still do your yearly show at Princeton?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. I'm going to be there this June. Yeah.
I hope when you are, you might join us live in our studio. I'd love to meet you sometime, and I love doing radio with live guests, except in your case, we made an exception because you're not here that often, and this is our second week, and I just thought we should pay tribute to some of the great voices of the past in New York City, and I'm delighted you're with us. You know, when people today talk about radiomonologists, people talk of people like Garrison Keillor, and I wonder if when you hear someone like that, you hear shades of yourself.
Well, my stuff was much more sardonic than Keillor's. I was more of a sardonic humorist and commentator on the scene, whereas he's kind of a cutesy poor nostalgist. That's like asking Picasso if he ever envies the guys that do the greeting cards. No, we're in a very different world.
I think we have your perspective on that, Gene.
All right.
Let's go to our telephone and say hello to Steve. You're on with Gene Shepherd on WMC.
Oh, man. Hey, this is one of the best guests you ever had, Mr. Dean Shepherd?
Gina, I should warn you about Steve. I'm sure Steve will speak for himself. Go ahead, Steve.
Dean Shepherd?
Yes?
Oh, man, Christmas Story, the best movie I've ever seen in my whole life. Hey, I got some questions. You can answer them for me?
Okay, what have you got?
You still have the Red Ryder rifle and the bunny suit?
Well, I have. They gave me the rifle that was used in the movie. That is an actual Red Ryder BB gun, and when we finished shooting the movie, MGM gave it to me, and yes, I do have it. It's hanging in my studio right now.
Hey, how about the bunny suit?
I never had a bunny suit. I just invented that.
Hey, if you didn't really say fudge, what did you say?
Well, don't forget we're on the radio.
You can't say it on the radio?
Be careful. I'm liable to shoot your eye out.
All right, Steve. Thank you.
Hi.
And Vinny from Long Island, you're on WMCA.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Hi.
Mr. Shepherd, I love your books and everything. I was wondering if there were any plans to reprint that classic gothic romance, I, Libertine.
Oh, no, that was just a
I've never heard you tell the story of I, Libertine. I've heard it from 100 people.
I've told it at times. I guess you just weren't around, you know. I told the story, but
what?
I'm not going to do it tonight because it would take 45 minutes.
We got about 30.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not going to do that. But anyway, thank you for remembering it. And
give the paper back. He won't even let anybody touch it.
Well, it's worth some money now, you know.
No, it's worth a couple hundred as far as...
Yeah, that's right. Don't let that thing out of your hands. A lot of people are very careless with paperbacks, not realizing that many of them are worth a lot of money these days. And that one is. That's one of them.
All right, thank you.
By the way, I don't have a copy of it myself, Eddie.
But thank you. You know, Gene, you were just telling me during the break that you don't have copies or tape copies of your shows from WOR.
No.
And a listener has said that he has saved them. Many people may have saved your stuff over the years, but you yourself don't have access to these tapes, do you?
No, my wife is you know, I move around a lot, and I live in different places, and I don't want to get burdened down with great big file cabinets full of tapes and clippings and all that. I don't even have clippings. I don't keep clippings. You know, most guys keep scrapbooks of...
Do you have a resume?
It's about 3 sentences long. No, seriously, I found early on in my life that it's so easy to get yourself bogged down with old papers and memorabilia and all that kind of stuff, and I'm just not a nostalgic type. I never look in the past at all, and it's there, I've done it, I move on. And, you know, if others collect things, fine, that's okay for them, but I just don't burden my life with all that stuff.
Does it ever irk you to be talked to about the old days in WOR? Because you certainly have moved on to do many other things, and yet to a radio audience in New York, you are remembered for that to a large extent, and I wonder if it bothers you to have to talk about it.
No, I would love to have them once in a while talk about, you know, some of the more current things that I've done. You know, in other words, if somebody said, gee, how did you shoot such and such a scene in Christmas Story? How'd you come up with the idea for Ollie Hot Noodle's Haven of Bliss? Which, by the way, I have a movie that's right now we're one of the finalists. We're up for the Ace Award, which is going to be Sunday night, a big Hollywood show. And it's for the best movie on cable television this past year. I did a film for Disney called Ollie Hot Noodle's Haven of Bliss that I wrote and produced and whatnot. And so we're sitting here waiting to see how we do Sunday night. I should go there, you know, rent a tux and sit there with Burt Reynolds and all that. But
why don't you do that?
Oh, those events are always so contrived, Alan. They, you know, all the agents invite all the people they're trying to promote and all that. They all sit around and pretend that they all know Jane Fonda.
Well, think of how much material that kind of scene would give you.
Well, it would, except that it's not my kind of material. It is a lot of material, but I've gone to a couple of those in the past. We were up for a Critics Circle Award here a couple of years ago with Phantom of the Open Heart, and that was some scene. I mean, there was a fist fight breaks out at the next table just out of camera range. A couple of actors started to yell, and one guy's poop fell off, and I mean, it was...
Gene Shepherd, our guest on WMCA, and Bob claims he is a friend of yours. Is that right, Bob?
Yes, hi, Gene.
Bob who?
Gaffney.
Oh, Oh, for heaven's sakes, Bob Gaffney.
Yeah, I've been...
by the way, Alan, Bob Gaffney and I are old companions in arms. We spent time in Lebanon, and we bought art objects in Pompeii.
So you two do know each other.
Oh, we sure do. And we were aboard the USS Essex when they landed Marines in Lebanon. Yeah, Bob and I go way back. And,
we were making movies then, Gene.
What's that?
We were making movies then, see?
That's right. And I want to tell you, yes, we did. We made a movie. Joseph Levine, I think, put the dough into it, didn't he?
Yeah,
a film. Bob and I did a film. It was a film called The Light Fantastic.
Right.
And it was a lot of fun. So, yes, Bob and I go back. He's in the movie industry, incidentally, Alan. And he has the distinction of creating one of the 10 worst movies ever made.
The Eggplant That Ate Chicago?
Tell him, Bob, what it is.
It was called Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster.
That was your movie, Bob?
Yes.
Boy, what a feather in the cap that is.
It became a cult classic for all the movies that you've never wanted to admit that you saw.
Did you think it was bad when you were making it?
Oh, no, we had a lot of fun.
Well, I thought the scene was really great when the spaceship was landing, you know, and it lands on that sand dune. And in the background, you see a guy go over a sand dune in the back riding the golf cart.
Right.
and a moving truck went by, you know, that was supposed to be on another planet. Oh, it was a great movie, Bob. Terrific to hear you.
It's great to talk to you too, Gene. I love your Christmas story.
Did you? Thank you very much. I wonder if Louis de Rochemont would have liked it.
Oh, Louis would have, yeah.
Well, you know, if you two guys like, we can butt out and let you two just talk.
Well, the thing is, Alan, that Bob is a very interesting guy, and he and I worked together way back when I first came to New York, and I was really in the movie world. See, a lot of people think this is new to me, but I was hired by the de Rochemont Corporation, which was a famous movie corporation at the time. They made things like Walk East on Beacon and the Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone and the Cardinal. Big movies, big heavyweights. And I was working for them as a writer, and I also appeared in a few of them doing narrations and stuff. And Bob worked for the de Rochemont Company, too, and we became close friends.
Bob, I thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks a lot.
Good to hear from you, Bob.
Take care, Gene.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Gene, do you regularly, you must be always getting new ideas that you're jotting down, and what's the process like? Something comes into your head, and you decide, this will make a great movie.
That's a very interesting question, and it's not easy to answer. You know, that's one of those things you can come up with a glib answer, but it isn't that easy. For example, when we did Christmas Story, that started with a short story, you see. I'd written a short story that appeared in Playboy called The Red Rider Nails the Cleveland Street Kid. And it was kind of a big success. You know, a lot of people liked it, and it won a couple of short story awards. And then years went by, and then I included in God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, really, as the first chapter.
Uh-huh.
And how this started out as an idea for a movie, one day, out of the blue, I got a call from Bob Clark, who is the director, and the guy that created Porky's, by the way. You remember Porky?
All three of them.
Yeah, well, he didn't do the other two. He did the original one. And Bob called me, and he said, I want to make a movie with you. And I said, well, fine. What do you got in mind? He said, well, I think that short story, that first chapter of In God We Trust about the kid and the baby gun will make a fantastic film. And I said, you get these calls all the time, incidentally, and you get so that you don't really listen to them. And he said that it would make a great film, and I said, okay, fine, what do we do from now? I said, what do you really want to do? And he said, yeah. And he said, wait, I'll give you a call and let you know. And so 2 years went by, I never heard from him again, and you know how this happens. You know, the woods are full of phone booth Indians, you know, coming up making deals. So he... 2 years went by, all of a sudden I got a call from him again. He said, I'm in a position now. Let's move. I said, well, now, wait a minute here, Bob. Are you really serious? He said, look, 2 years, I'm not kidding. So anyway, ultimately, 4 years later, we started actual work on the film. Now, how it started was a combination of Bob wanting to make a movie out of that story and me writing the script. And so it was a simple process. You don't just walk down the street and the light bulb goes off.
ideas forthcoming constantly? Is this an ongoing...
Oh, yeah. When you're in this business, you've got to keep your mind going. It's just like pro golfers. They have to practice. They're always out there putting and doing what they do. And you just keep getting ideas all the time.
But as a guy who used to come up with a new idea every single night, five nights a week, certainly being that prolific in the motion picture industry wouldn't translate.
Well, it does and it doesn't. You see, now, the ideas that I get these days, I don't think in terms of doing tonight's show like I did on radio. I think in terms of I'm going to include that idea in the next film I make.
Uh-huh.
And so I keep notes and lists of things, ideas that I'm going to use. For example, did you see Christmas Story?
You know, I've never seen it.
Oh, my. Well, there's a scene in there where a kid gets his tongue frozen to a light to a flagpole out in the schoolyard in the middle of winter, and it's one of the high points. Everybody talks about that scene. Well, that scene came about just as one of these notes. I said it'll make a great bit to because kids always are talking about putting their tongue on a flagpole, and so we did it in this film. So that's what I do now. You don't. It doesn't really translate the way it did in radio, which was immediate. You know, you'd go and do the show, and that's it.
That immediate gratification, though, is something thrilling about that, where you have to wait months or sometimes years in movies to get that kind of gratification.
Yeah, that's true. That is a big difference. But let me tell you what the other side of that is. But years after you've made a movie, you get reviews. Like, for example, the Boston Globe just did a big review on Christmas Story 4 years after we did it. And I get all kinds of reactions from the movie. But this was 4 years ago.
They never reviewed a radio show 4 years after you did that.
Never. In fact, I would say half the people in New York don't even remember I was on radio.
Well, I'm not sure about that. We'll find out more about those people as we take their calls in just a moment with Gene Shepard. We're 212-570-WMCA. Gene Shepard is our guest, and we think we may have gotten a better phone line this time.
Oh, that's terrific.
Maybe not. But anyway, let's go to our other... how is this? Is this any better?
Yeah, this sounds good to me.
Okay, it's a little better. Okay, let's say hello to Jack from South Amboy. You're on WMCA.
Yeah, Shep.
Hello, Jack.
Oh, man, glad to hear your voice again.
Good to hear you.
I've seen, about four times in the past 8 years down in Princeton.
Oh, yeah?
And this past time, it seemed like you didn't want to be there. It was a little bit inconvenient. I guess you were filming a movie or something.
Yeah, that's right. We had a little trouble that year. But we're going to be there with bells on this year.
Why was the trouble last year, Gene?
Well, I was filming a movie. And I had to leave the film, I had to leave the set and all that to come and do the show, and it was really tough. But we got it all straightened out and worked it out okay. Conflicts, that's all.
Do you perform live anywhere else?
Yes, I do. I do a lot of live stuff. In fact, I'm going out to, I just got back from, I'm going out to Oklahoma here in a week or two. I'm playing in Dayton here in a couple of weeks, and I'm playing MIT, by the way, in February. Oh, I do a lot of live stuff. Yeah, I love it.
I know the only place around New York, though, you do is Princeton, huh?
Well, that's enough, isn't it? Princeton.
Oh, yeah.
All right, thank you very much. Alan from Ocean Grove, you're on WMCA.
Alan, Gene.
Yes.
I consider it to be an honor to be speaking to who I consider to be the two greatest radio personalities of all time.
Well, I don't think you can put me in the class with Gene Shepard.
Come on, Alan. Don't be modest.
Okay, I think you're right, sir.
Anyway, I almost missed the fifth grade because I was smuggling a radio into bed and listening to you until wee hours of the morning.
It may surprise you to know that when I was doing those shows, I was in the seventh grade. As a matter of fact, you know, most people tend to think you must be 100 years old. But when I started in New York, I was today they call me a kid. I was, 21, 22, something like that. So I was not an elderly gentleman.
How many years was the WOR show in production?
We started, let me think here now. We started during the time of Kennedy, about 63, 62, something like that, 61.
Uh-huh.
And left the air there in
1977. Pretty good run, huh?
Well, I could have continued, but at that point I started to get involved with movies and I was doing the TV show on PBS, and it was just getting to be too much. You know, it was like I was running around You can't spread yourself too thin, Alan, and if you do, some of your work's got to suffer. And I just didn't want my radio work to suffer. I said, look, I've done a good run on it. I've done it, and that's it.
Did WR make entreaties to get you to stay?
Oh, yeah, they wanted, of course. You know, we've been there for years, but it was, they understood, and it was one of those things that just finally came to the point where I just simply said, look, in fact, they said, look, are you going to spend more time here in town doing the show, or do you want to go out to the coast to do movies? I said, well, I better move on.
And have other stations since then come across with offers to get lure you back?
Oh, yeah. There's been a couple of New York stations that wanted me to do, you know, they were gave me blank check, so ideas and all that stuff. But I don't want to get back into that grind, you know, every day having to be there.
What if it was once a week? And what if it was a network show once a week where you were heard on many stations throughout the country?
Well, that would be different. But network shows are so far and few between that... that's just one of those hypothetical questions.
Uh-huh. All right, Alan, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
And Barry from Rockland County, you're on with Gene Shepherd on WMCA.
Hi, Gene. I don't have any questions. I just wanted to heap some praise on your shoulders.
On what?
Heap some praise on your shoulders.
Oh, well, thank you.
I want to tell you that I have two little boys, 6 and 9, and for the past 3 years, we've been sitting down at Christmas time, turning on the movie, and just enjoying it tremendously.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, Barry.
And I want you to know, too, that I go back with you back to my summers when we used to spend time in Far Rockaway in the early 60s, listening to you, sitting late at night, listening to you talking about Sasquatches and Yetis. And do you remember those?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Oh, it was marvelous. I mean...
The New York Times, by the way, a few years ago said that it's quite probable that as an artist, you know, doing my show, that I influenced more teenagers and kids on the East Coast, all throughout, you know, the whole East Coast, because, you know, our station covered from Florida all the way up to Maine, and they said that they thought that I influenced more people of that generation than any other artist, writer, or whatever.
Well, you did with me. I ran right out and bought a couple of Yetis.
Well, I'm delighted that you listened to me. Thanks a lot. Well, glad your kids like the movie, by the way.
They love it, especially, as you noted before, the part with the tongue on the flagpole.
Well, you remind them, though, that they'll shoot their eye out.
You know what I'm curious about, Barry? How do you explain to your kids who Gene Shepherd is and what he represents to you?
I haven't tried, actually. No offense. But, you know, Gene, what they can relate to is being bundled up in that snowsuit. I don't know anyone who can't relate to that.
That's right. Well, see, Alan, the show, the movie, since you haven't seen the movie, has nothing to do with Gene Shepherd, the radio man. And so... It's as pure a movie as anything Dustin Hoffman ever did.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I was just curious. My question was coming from, did he try to explain to his kids, the guy who did this movie also once did something else, and let me tell you about this guy.
Well.
I want you to know one thing, though. I've never listened to anyone who can tell a story as well as Gene Shepherd can, anyone who can make you feel, even those beer commercials and the ice cream commercials you were doing. I mean, that's the purpose. You can make someone sit there and feel like, hey, let me have a can of beer or let me have some ice cream.
Barry, thank you.
Well, thank you, Barry.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Gene,
that was a terrific call, by the way.
Good. We'll compliment Melinda, who screened it. You know, did you ever want to do a show where you sat and talked to listeners and took phone calls and interviewed people and did other kinds of talk radio than monologues?
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I haven't really, seriously, because, you know, I'm a monologist, not a radio man. My job is to make people laugh and to do these stories. But one day, I was called over to a friend of mine who was managing WNBC at the time. WRCA?
It was WRCA and WNBC, both.
Yeah, it was WNBC at the time. Anyway, he said, I want to make you an offer, so... I said, fine, let's go and have lunch. So we did. We were sitting across the street from Rockefeller Center having a lunch in an Italian restaurant, one of those brownstones, you know, upstairs type place.
Uh-huh.
We were sitting there, and his name was George Skinner, incidentally.
Uh-huh.
He'd been the manager there, and he was offering me a show. He says, look, he says, I know what you do. He said, but I think you could really did it as a comic rather than as a, you know, the classical phone guy who says, and yes, sir, what do you think of the drug situation, you know, and so on. So we're sitting there talking when all of a sudden a guy came running into the restaurant and grabbed George and whispered something into George's ear and ran out again. Don't forget, we're across the street from Radio City.
Uh-huh.
George jumped up and says, my God, Shepard, Kennedy's been shot.
Wow.
And that was where I was the very minute that Kennedy shot, talking about doing a talk show on NBC. And I had already said, no, I didn't want to do it, but it was a fascinating moment, and I'll never forget that day.
It's amazing you bring that up, because I was going to ask you if, on days like the day Kennedy was shot, and I had this question in my head before you told that story, if on days like that, when you got on the air that night, did you change what you had planned and deal with the events of the day?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one show that I have a tape of. I did a show about Kennedy. I had met him a couple of times, you know, and all this, what he meant to the people of that generation, and of which I was part of, I had worked for Kennedy, privately, as a private citizen. And, in fact, I remember going to the big rally that Kennedy had at, it was up at the Civic Center there. They had a great big rally for Kennedy about two or three days before the, election.
Uh-huh.
And all the showbiz types were there, Sammy Davis and Frank Sinatra and the whole bit. He was a very showbiz president. I did a whole thing about that great mistake. And yes, I did change my show. The same thing that happened the night that Martin Luther King was killed.
Uh-huh.
And people had those and kept them. Because, see, the one thing I always thought of my show as also was a continuing, running, I suppose you might say more artistic and tongue-in-cheek and yet sardonic, but yet true, record of our time, of things that happened in our time daily. I would do things about what Wagner had done that day,
uh-huh.
or Mayor Wagner. And if you had all these tapes, you could practically put together a history of the era. I was part of the hippie movement, by the way, as you may know. No, I really was.
Uh-huh.
I seriously was. In fact, I was one of the first writers for the Village Voice.
Uh-huh. I'm aware of that, and I'm aware of your appearing regularly in Greenwich Village at the Limelight, where you...
More than that, I worked for The Realist. I was considered one of the leading... In fact, I'm a character in On the Road. John Kerouac's novel.
Uh-huh.
John Kerouac. The character is the angel-headed hippie in the guy that did a radio show that all of them listened to in On the Road. So I was part of that movement, and when I did the Kennedy thing that night, I knew that it was the end of an era. I just instinctively knew that everything was different from now on.
We're on 570 WMCA. I'm Alan Colmes. Our guest is Gene Shepard. Tomorrow night, Roger Grimsby joins us. And we're at 212-570-WMCA. Now, a lot of people cannot get through or would like to talk to Gene, would like to contact Gene, but can't. But I've extracted a promise from Gene that the next time he's in New York, he will do our show live in our studios. And since I'm saying it publicly, so he's going to have to be held to that.
Oh, don't worry. I keep my promises, Alan.
And let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. Gil from Brooklyn.
How you doing? First of all, Gene, I just want to say that how much I enjoyed that movie. It was absolutely fantastic.
Well, thank you very much.
And one part I think I related to most was, remember that incident in the movie where the character played by, was his name Bill Nighy?
Would you repeat the question?
Excuse me?
Repeat the question.
The question was about the part where he is listening to a old radio show, Who Off Nanny. And he weeks and months pass, and he's like, he gets this decoder. And he's waiting to figure out what the message says. And after all that, all it says is, drink Ovaltine. And I can really relate to that because I remember sending away some stuff in the back of comic books that didn't work either.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And certainly it may be interesting to you to know that Rex Reed absolutely blasted the movie.
Thank you for your call. And Gene, I hope to meet you in person someday. It would be a real thrill, and I wish you the best and hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks very much. 7 o'clock at WMCA, New York.